Welcome to the Aesthetic City podcast. In this show, we aim to discover how to go forward and create a more livable, beautiful, and healthy built environment. I'm Ruben Hansen, your host and founder of the Aesthetic City. Today's guest is a professor and an experienced classical architect from the USA. He has over 16 years of experience in both new construction and renovation, and has worked for private sector developers, state universities, governmental agencies, religious institutions, and more. Apart from working as an architect, he's professor at Utah Valley University, where he has developed curricula for new courses. He is active as a researcher and has many publications to his name, of which many about sacred architecture. He has his own firm, Tetrit Architecture and Planning, which focuses on a variety of projects. Finally, he has an excellent YouTube channel with many videos on how to draw the orders, lectures, and more. So please welcome Professor Brennan Rowe. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So great to have you here. So yeah, first of all, just a question about your background. Where are you based actually?
I am based in Utah in the United States, and we're kind of in the Rocky Mountain region. And so I'm teaching full-time at Utah Valley University. It's a new architecture program that actually has a focus on traditional classical design. And so we're kind of unique in that aspect.
So what drove you to become an architect, and where did your passion initially come from?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. The origin story of all of us. I would say when I was a little kid, I always had a desire to be artistic and would love to draw things. As a young child, I was also really fascinated with trains and would kind of draw train layouts and things like that. So kind of the spatial master planning, if you will, but playing with Legos, wood blocks. And in fact, I was looking at some old pictures the other day and seeing some photographs of myself as a young child playing with Legos and building cities and buildings and things like that. So all of that kind of stemmed from this desire to become an architect. So strong suits in arts and math. So I guess that's kind of where it all began.
Yeah. It's similar to how I experienced my own growth in interest in those areas with the Legos, the wood blocks, but fascinating. So when you were studying to become an architect, what were your ideals and your ideas about what you wanted to do and achieve, and how did these ideas form?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, when I was beginning my pursuit of becoming an architect, I first started taking a few classes actually in high school, some architectural drafting classes, and that kind of stemmed the interest. But like principles-based ideals that I was searching for, I really wanted to learn from the ancients. And what were these principles? You know, ancient Egypt, you think of these cool pyramids and temples and things like that. Why did these buildings last the test of time? Right. So I was looking at what makes architecture timeless. And so that was one of the things I was really searching for. And what were those principles? And then ultimately, what made these buildings desirable or delightful that people didn't tear them down after a certain period of time? So that was my search, right? As I started going through the educational process and learning about architecture. Yeah. Those are some of the things guiding me.
And your time in university, did you like it there? Like what kind of experience did you have there? I assume you were educated in the modernist fashion.
Yes, I was. Early on, I started in the community college, and by one of my early design classes, stemming from that desire to learn these principles, I stumbled across a paper actually by Nico Salangaros, a mathematician who was talking about these patterns and how they could be applied to architecture. So at a very early stage, my first design project, I was seeing, okay, how can these parabolas and, you know, math concepts be applied to directly to architecture? And that project turned out kind of horrible, but it was a learning experience in and of itself. And then from there, I went to Cal Poly Pomona near Los Angeles in California. And there was able to have a professor that was somewhat sympathetic to the classical traditional methods. He was teaching architectural history. And so he let us do a small design project where when we're learning out about the Renaissance to design a facade, right, in the Renaissance language. And that was just really fascinating for me, the proportions and all of those. And then he actually had a design studio that was centered in Venice on the Grand Canal. And he got to choose a mentor architect at that point. And I decided to choose Andrea Palladio to once again learn from the ancients and some of these principles. And the funny thing here, I'm in a modern school where looking back to history is not always viewed in a positive light. And so because of that, during the design review, I had some members of the jury that were reacting, why in the world did you look to Palladio, right? Why was he your mentor and not Rem Koolhaas or Frank Gehry or some of these others, right? And here, Venice, right? Yep. A very historic landscape and urban setting. And so I was trying to be respectful and fit into that surroundings. And it was interesting. They just were baffled at why I wanted to do this. And my response was, I wanted to learn these principles, right? I wanted to learn how these great architects of the past designed something to be timeless, beautiful, and they just didn't understand that.
Yeah. And did you have a reaction to that, or what was their reaction to that reaction?
But they just said, you know, there's no need to look to the past, really. Why everything we need to know, we kind of need a clean slate, tabula rasa approach almost, right? Where we're only thinking about the future.
Yeah.
We're not building upon precedents or case, you know, principles of the past, that kind of thing. So,
yeah. Yeah, I'm always thinking, like, for me, it seems very logical to look back on former successful recipes or methods, designs, and to learn from. And I guess in there are probably universities where they actually do study previous examples a bit more intensely, but then try to use them in a completely new and innovative way. But this is even one step further, and God forbid you actually start to apply them directly without irony. But what do you think? Why their way of thinking is so much aimed towards the future and towards what is happening now? Why do you think it's so strongly aimed at only the future? And how could it be so illogical for them to take the past as an example?
I think part of it is their, you know, the early fathers of modernism, when Walter Gropius came to the United States, you know, after starting the Bauhaus and that tradition. When he was at Harvard, if you looked at some of the curriculum that they were emphasizing and requiring students to go through, history, courses in history were not even part of the curriculum.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, there's this really stark break with tradition. And it also stems from the Beaux-Arts method, which was heavily in precedence and looking to the past and building off of the, you know, the work of the ancients. And so there's basically this rejection of the past in many ways. Now, I have to give my former institution some credit. They did place an emphasis on precedent or case study analysis, but it was more not using a precedent to help inform your design, but it was more studying the function of a specific space or looking at the sustainability aspects or how it was pushing a certain social connection or agenda, those kind of things. And so it was looking at architecture from that aspect. And most of the precedents and case studies we did look at were contemporary after the modern movement. So, in a way, you know, there are schools that take this to some degree more serious than others, where it's, you can never look to the past, even to your modern contemporaries. But in and of itself, as I think as human beings as designers, we tend to look, just this process of imitation when we're learning to talk or crawl as an infant. We're trying to imitate and go through that process. And it's innate in us as human beings.
Yeah. Yeah, because you looked at religious buildings, for example, and you got, if I'm correct, very interested in sacred geometry and proportions and sacred architecture, basically. So could you tell a bit about that?
Yeah, so in my senior year at Cal Poly, I decided to design a religious building because I was once again trying to search out these principles. And so studying different traditions and things like that. And then ultimately that desire led me to go to graduate school at the Catholic University of America. Mm-hmm. So moving almost 3,000 miles away, the other side of the United States, from California to Washington, D.C. And at the time, it was the only program in the country that really had an emphasis or concentration in this sacred space. And so I was able to learn more from that. And I came across a very interesting book in my studies by A.T. Mann called Sacred Architecture. And he was an architect that I think he studied at Cornell University. And in his process, he was really frustrated. He was kind of like me, and I sympathized. He was trying to search for these patterns, this language of the ancients, couldn't find it anywhere. Basically had to, and he went and worked for some of the great architects, even Walter Gropius's former office in Rome, and in other architects in New York, and just none of these great architects knew these patterns, these proportions. And so he ultimately left and went to India and studied astrology and other things, but then came back and wrote a book, right, for architects that they could use. And so that story was really interesting for me because I was searching for geometries, patterns, proportions to learn from them. And once again, going back to that timeless architecture, what were the buildings that lasted the test of time? They're usually religious buildings, sacred buildings. And so what a better place to start than studying those types of building types.
Yeah. And what kind of temples did you initially study?
Yeah. So at Catholic University, it wasn't just a focus on Catholic religious buildings. We studied Hindu, Buddhist, all different religious traditions to really try to grasp and understand these principles. So some of my research there did focus specifically on some Catholic buildings. I looked a lot at the Pantheon, Chartres Cathedral, and I even looked at Bronchamp Chapel by Le Corbusier, right? The modern version.
Yeah.
To kind of get a breadth of how people experience these buildings across time and across different architectural styles. And that was really kind of a lot of my research there was focused on that. And then also kind of comparing different religious traditions and looking for similarities and patterns. And so one book that really helped inform my vision as how I approach design as an architect, and now as I teach it, was this two-volume series published by Harvard University called The Hermeneutics of Sacred Architecture. And hermeneutics is just a fancy word for interpretation, like how do we interpret architecture? And with that, there's a framework in there that I really used and have been able to use in a number of ways. And has been really helpful as just a student, as an architect, you know, dealing with clients and trying to look at these priorities that kind of shift over time and how you can discern them in different religious traditions, but also how do you then teach these, right, to the next generation of design professional.
Yeah. So you talk a lot about timeless architecture. What is your definition of timeless? Because I know, for example, that Robert Adam, the British architect who wrote a book on time and architecture, has his problems with the word timeless, because it's never really timeless looking at the full duration of the existence of the universe. But still, it might be a useful term to express something about the values. But what is your view on timeless architecture?
Yeah, and Robert Adam's book is a great introduction to that topic. I highly recommend it for those interested in a deep dive. But I would say, and you know, maybe we'll talk a little bit about this towards the end, but one of the ideals that I promote with my students and our new program here at Utah Valley is building for time. And that doesn't necessarily suggest timeless architecture, but architecture that lasts longer than the current trends. Some of my clients have asked for a 20-year building because they anticipate that the building's going to be destroyed. And so the material choices, the cost, all of those kind of things go into that factor. But instead, if we think about building for time, not in terms of decades, but building for generations, that gets us to think about architecture differently. How can I design a building to last more than just 20 years, but last a generation, if not multiple generations? And so material choices, those kind of things are really critical with that. Also from a sustainability standpoint. So when I say timeless architecture, when I was a student, right, I viewed it as, well, these buildings that have really lasted the test of time and still somewhat resonate with us as human beings. There's something familiar that they're not like the fashion industry where it gets outdated so quickly.
Yeah.
There's principles that have been time tested that we can apply and that will last longer. I don't know if
helped. That's a very clear answer. And I think, I agree with that point, because I think even though timeless might be, as a word, perhaps difficult, I still think it's a useful term or a useful concept to use. And to, we need buildings that last longer, I believe. So, So you have 16 years of experience and you are the lead architect of your own firm, Tetrad Architecture.
Tetrad, yeah.
What kinds of projects do you mainly do?
Yeah, so my firm, prior to that, I worked in a number of architecture offices around the country, some large, some really small, national firms, firms that mostly are focused on modern design, because most people are architects are trained in the modern aesthetic. Decided, once I went into academia full time and teaching, that it would be nice to remain connected to practice. And so a year and a half or so ago, I started Tetrad Architecture and Planning, and we focus on a lot of residential projects, but we do some commercial work as well. We're looking at doing a small addition to a historic museum here in Utah, where we're creating an outdoor meditation garden space. The projects can vary from time to time, whether it's residential or commercial, but currently my firm, that's some of the projects we work on.
Nice. And what has been your favorite kind of project to take on so far? Where do you get most out of?
Yeah, I would say we've talked already a little bit about religious and sacred architecture, and those projects have been truly my favorite. I've designed several buildings in different locations across the United States, as well as in Europe, and several meeting houses and things like that. But these projects, I think, I have a stronger connection with because of my background in education and desires. But it also allows you to dive into symbolism, sacred geometry, proportions. You are also working sometimes with the trades, with stained glass and ornament, and to be able to really communicate ideals or beliefs, right, through architectural materials and elements. And so those have been really been some of the more delightful projects to work on. But yeah, beyond that, I've worked on healthcare and higher education buildings, schools, a courthouse, other things like that. And they have their pros and cons too. But there's something special, I think, about religious and sacred buildings.
Yeah, because you worked on some designs for, if I'm correct, for example, the Baton Rouge Temple, the Oklahoma City Temple. Can you tell some details about those projects? What really was the challenge there?
Yeah, part of the challenge is those projects were existing, so they were renovation projects. It wasn't just a small little remodel. It was a complete redo of the entire thing, part of building envelope issues and moisture penetration and things like that. But because of that, we were able to look at the original and the design intent. But at the time, the client really wanted a classical building. The original building was very modern in some ways, reduced cornices and molding details and things like that. But we were able to apply the classical language to this project. And I think one of the great things about it was really able to align some of the nuances and problems of the original project. There was a disconnect, we'll just say, between the exterior design and the interior, and how it was working with massing and the formal language and window placement and things like that. So it was really a huge problem solving endeavor in many ways. But also, one of the aspects of those projects was going to the site, visiting the local historic architecture, studying the motifs, the local flora, fauna, et cetera, and how do you incorporate that to give it a sense of connection to the place, the spirit of the place, as well as the religious aspects of it.
Yeah, sounds super interesting. So it was a rework of a modern construction and to apply the classical language to it. Do you think that it's possible for a big part of the modern buildings we build today, or is it hard to adapt to the classical language? Like, what percentage would you think?
You know, that's an interesting point. You're familiar with Leon Krier, and he does some interesting counter proposals in his design work. Some of the early modernist projects, like Corbusier's Villa Savoie or others, right? And if we were to apply to a classical language to this, what would it look like? I think it's kind of interesting that dialogue that could take place with these counter proposals and using the same structural grid and other things like that. I do think there's some possibility there. Recently, you know, our university campus here at Utah Valley is a very brutalist architecture, concrete, glass, steel, that kind of thing. Yeah. And I recently gave a presentation to our university president, and she said, "Well, what do you think about our architecture? Is it salvable?" Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Could we apply this kind of classical, traditional aesthetic to it? And in some ways, I think it's too much time and money to abolish everything and start over. But there's some cases where some buildings, like those temple projects that you were mentioning, where it makes sense, right? And it makes sense for the client. Yeah. You know, that same client has other temple projects that were designed in a very modern aesthetic. And surprisingly, attendance from their believers and patrons to those buildings has gone down compared to the buildings that are designed in a more traditional or Gothic Revival or other language. And so they've even gone to great lengths to give them a facelift and apply that language to them. And it's significantly increased, right, the attendance by patrons and other things like that. So it's an interesting phenomenon, right, where modern buildings, as human beings, besides architects that are trained to love them, would typically gravitate to buildings that have certain patterns and proportions in them.
Yeah, that's a fascinating topic indeed. I think I want to come back to the topic of attraction to certain styles, but I think it also ties into the sacred geometry and those topics as well. What makes people have mental experience in some places, but that's for a bit later. First, I want to ask you about your roles in education, because you have various roles in architectural education, as you are an assistant professor of architecture at Utah Valley University, and you did a course at the City College of New York, if I'm correct. And you also have a great YouTube account, which has a lot of really good talks and lessons. So yeah, how did you get involved in teaching at Utah Valley?
Yeah, that's a great question. Our program here started in fall of 2019, and that's when I was hired. My colleague, David Barker, started the program, and, when they put out an advertisement, I was living in Idaho at the time. It's about 5 hours north of Utah. It's a different state. And I saw this opportunity, and I had previously worked in Salt Lake City here in Utah and had a lot of connections. There's a great organization called the Institute of Classical Architecture and Art that's national, but we have a chapter here in Utah. And my colleague David was able to go to some of these workshops that they host. He was trained in a modern school as well, and really fell in love. And it was like, why did we never learn this in architecture school? And so he decided to, we're going to do something different. There's only one other architecture program in the state at the University of Utah, and they're a very progressive, innovative architecture program, the modernist. And so we're going to do something a little different. So I saw this advertisement, right, that they're going to do something different. And so being part of that, I thought, this is going to be great. I always wanted to eventually teach. Didn't know it was going to come this early in my career, but decided to apply and ended up getting the job. So I was hired in fall 2019. We started with 20 students, and we've grown to almost over 250 students now in a short amount of time, only 3.5 years. And, you know, what that goes to show is that there's just a huge interest in the traditional approach to design. I think for one, it resonates with most human beings, and especially students here in the state of Utah. And so with that, him and I, we co-founded the program, and I've been teaching and developing curriculum for over half of the core architecture classes. So you could say I'm one of the co-founders with him for this program and the vision of what it is and what we teach.
Fantastic. And the students, when they graduate, what do they generally do next? What other studies are they going to do? Are they working? Are they flowing off into the labor market directly? Or what is their continuation of their path?
Yeah, our students, it's interesting you ask that. Most of them, the way that our program works is you get a 2-year associate's degree. And that's how where this architecture kind of stemmed from, was an associate's in architectural drafting. And then they apply formally to get into the program in the third. The program's 5 years in total, bachelor program. And when they graduate, most of them already have jobs, believe it or not. I would say 90-95% of our students, once they get in year 3 through 5, they are employed, already working in architecture offices. And so they're getting a good balance of the practical skills that they're needing. But they're also making a huge difference. Some of them I know have already been able to design traditional projects in their respective offices and teach these principles now to others that never had that education. And so it's interesting to see that. And we're just getting close to graduating our first cohort of students. So it'll be nice to see where they head in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Oh, that's really great to hear. Are you aware of, apart from Notre Dame University, other programs similar to this one, which have this kind of oil spill effect?
Yeah, there, for a long time, Notre Dame was the only program in the country and world that really had this focus. More and more schools have been popping up, and I think it's in large part due to the demand of interest in traditional and classical vernacular architecture. So there's Notre Dame, right? That's a program that's 100% committed basically to this approach to design stemming from a Beaux-Arts tradition.
Yeah.
There's our program here at Utah Valley University that is 100% right focused on this. There's a small college, Benedictine College in Kansas, that is a, it doesn't have a professional degree, but it's a pre-professional degree in architecture that focuses on this. And other than that, there's other programs that have a concentration. My alma mater university has actually started a concentration in classical design and urban design. University of Miami in Florida has a program that focuses a little bit on this. Georgia Tech at one point had some emphasis on this, University of Colorado. So you can see that there's more and more programs that are starting to gain this this traction, and either holding a concentration where you can go into this route or not, or there's faculty that will teach a class here or there. But most of the schools, if they do even get close to this topic, it's going to be a historic preservation approach to it.
Yeah. So what attracts you in being an educator?
You know, I think the thing I love the most about teaching, and I don't view myself as the sage on the stage, okay, the wise guy. I view myself more as the guide on the side. I'm really guiding students through this process of discovery and learning these principles and applying them to the projects. And so with that, when students kind of the light bulb goes on and they're able to get the concept, that's the most rewarding thing for me. And then just seeing their progress over time, you know, some of these students, I've had them all the way in their first year, and now they're in their fourth year, and just the progress they've made from those early classes and drawing the classical orders and applying it to a small design problem to now they're designing full-scale museums and cathedrals and, you know, those kind of things. Just the progress they're able to make is humbling and inspiring.
Yeah, yeah, I can fully imagine. So you also have, of course, your YouTube channel. And what have your experiences been with YouTube so far?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, the YouTube thing really came from the COVID-19 pandemic and trying to still teach classes during that. In fact, recall that spring of 2020 is when the pandemic started. And only recently, things are starting to improve and travel restrictions lifted and masks and other things. But because of that, I was trying to teach a hybrid method where I'm teaching part online and some face-to-face still. And it was really difficult to get through some of the content with the limited amount of times we were able to meet in person and things like that. So I decided to put some of my lectures and things on YouTube. And surprisingly, it was just designed for my students. And it took off, really. And some of my videos have thousands of views already. And I wasn't intending that. But there seems to have caught this interest. And it's not just, and you can see globally who's subscribing and to your channel and other things. A lot of it's international. There's an interest in this language of design. And when I was working with you at the Classic Planning Institute, for instance, you know, some of the students had already stumbled across my YouTube channel and had seen some of those. It was kind of interesting. And your colleagues, we had some from Australia, Saudi Arabia, other places, right? The UK. So YouTube's kind of an interesting platform in and of itself, but there's an immense interest, I think, in that. And also, I would say, because architecture schools are 99% teaching a modern ideology and approach to design, it's giving the minority voice a platform to be heard. So platforms like YouTube and others. So that's the biggest thing I think I've taken away from it.
Yeah. Because you have already quite some videos on there drawing the various orders, some lectures about sacred architecture, very interesting one about these temple complexes where you go through all these spaces as like this sequential experience. What is next? What other kind of videos do you have ideas for?
I think the biggest one is, I've been meaning to put them out, but when I start students out on this path of our very first class, it's called the Classical Architecture Workshop. And this is what I taught a similar class at City College of New York. And we focus on the sacred geometry aspect. So I would say the next videos that are going to be coming out are walking you through the numbers 1 through 12 and how those patterns can be found everywhere in terms of geometric polygons and how we can see those and things like that. But I've also got a number of presentations I've recently done at a conference at California Baptist a few weeks ago that will be coming online here shortly, talking about 4 ideals for the future of architecture, tying to beauty and timeless and other things. But I would think those are the next things. And then possibly seeing a couple of other lectures. I teach a course on culture and behavior in architecture, which is architectural theory, but looking at how buildings affect us, the science, the neuroscience behind it. So I've got some other lectures on there that will be coming online as well.
Yeah, sounds good. And as you said, so YouTube is a way to give a voice to a minority, a minority group in architecture at the moment. What kind of effects do you think it has right now? This collection of YouTube films, because I don't see this minority group represented in a genre on YouTube very strongly yet. But do you think this is changing, or what do you think is, what is the effect of these videos?
I think it is slowly changing. At one point, part of my philosophy as an educator is I believe that educating the masses is important, right? And if you have an important message to be heard, you should put it out there for the world, and you shouldn't have to pay for it and those kind of things. There's a time and place for higher education and paying for college and those kind of things. But a few years ago, Harvard, MIT, and some other Ivy League schools put together a platform called EdX. And EdX, and even Notre Dame partnered with them at one point to get an architecture history class out there. But that platform is basically free education. You can take a Harvard class or MIT class or a class from University of London or other places, right, for free. And you can get the education. You don't get the credentials and the diploma and those kind of things, but the education is free. And so that concept of just putting content out there and for whoever's interested, being able to find it. And so I strongly believe in that. But getting back to your question, I think over time that there will be this trickle effect. And I view it more as, there's this great illustration by Leon Krier where he's got a window outside a real estate office. And all these people are like looking at all these homes, like traditional looking homes, right, in different styles and whatnot that they want to purchase. And then there on the other side of the illustration, there's this window showing the School of Architecture, and it shows all the student projects, and they look all avant-garde, blobitecture or sculptural, right, in a way, neo-expressionist, and yet no one's looking there except the architecture student, and it has each professor's name under each student project. Basically, that sums up, right, what's going on. Most people, right, if you're just thinking about economics, most people want these traditional beautiful buildings. And similar to the video you put out recently through the Aesthetic City, you pointed out that a lot of these modern architects actually live in traditional buildings, classical buildings, and things like that. But yet the clients want this, but the architects are producing things they don't want. So there's a disconnect, and it's an education problem that ties to ideology and other things. I think part of it is, as schools catch on, architects are going to have more work. You're going to have job security. If you're producing what people want, number one, not to get really consumerist, right? But if you're designing buildings that no one wants, you're going to be out of the work pretty soon. So I don't know if does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. I'm thinking a little bit about Ayn Rand's book, The Fountainhead, and the feeling that some architects or modern architects might get with this whole idea that students should learn to design for the masses as some sort of a selling out. I think one of the characters in Fountainhead is represented by this guy who is not true to himself and is selling out by designing classically in that book, while the protagonist is this visionary who designs modernism. I'm not sure what your opinions are about that book. I saw the play actually, and it was fascinating, but I wonder if this gap could be bridged between designing for actually what would work better in society and what perhaps strikes the interest and fancy of designers and researchers who want to always do the avant-garde thing, because that's where innovation is. But it also seems like this train of innovation has stormed in a direction which has little to do with what happens on the ground anymore. I don't know, maybe this is all kind of a conceptual cloud, but I guess my question is, how could this gap be bridged between building what people would like, which is of course way more than that? It is also everything we talked about, sacred geometry, studying a lot of precedent, it's making use of the precedent versus also having space for innovation.
You know, one thing that I would say is that for my modern colleagues is that they often feel that if you're designing with the classical orders or using these proportions and things, you're limited by what you can do because you're following a certain set of rules and guidelines. But it's the same thing with building codes, right? As you're going through and you've got setbacks and height requirements and construction materials and egress and all those kind of things, it's the same set of principles, right? You've got parameters that are affecting your design. And in the rich classical tradition, and when we say classical, I hope people don't just think of Greco-Roman either. When we think of, say, classical, we're going beyond just Western architecture. We're going to ancient China and vernacular traditions and the building arts and how we've constructed buildings over time. And that there's a wide variety of languages. And I like to think of classical architecture as a language. It's not a style. And with languages, you can also have accents. So here in the United States, everyone speaks English or, and if you go to different parts of the country, peoples have almost like a different dialect. And I also speak Spanish, and I lived in South America for a period of time and then went to Italy, as a student and was able to communicate, and they thought I was from Spain. Right. But my accent was a little different. But just that nuance of language and how it can differ from each place. And it's the same with architecture. So it's not that we're saying innovation is bad. or invention is bad. I think what starts to be serious is that when our creative expression of the avant-garde actually does harm on human health and well-being, that we've gone too far.
Yeah.
And I think, so to get back to your question, what is the solution here? And I think it's in some ways science and some of the studies that are coming out. We didn't talk about some of my research, but Ann Sussman and others, they're using eye tracking software and visual attention software that basically simulates right where eyes are moving with an object. And so you can do that for a building facade, but you can also do that with the neuroscience side of things. And I've got colleagues and others who are dabbling in this and trying to understand it at a greater level. And so I think science, when used properly, can also help reinforce and give us answers to why traditional classical is so popular. There's a recent study in the United States, a survey that was conducted to show, you know, for federal architecture, Justin Shubo and his colleagues at the Civic Art Foundation put together this survey, the Harris Poll, to understand preferences. Do you prefer modern courthouses or more traditional? And the visual preference survey showed that 72% of Americans preferred traditional buildings. And one of my students and I took those same buildings to just verify the results. And we put it through this eye tracking simulation software to see, okay, what's going to happen, right? Where, if you have both images in front of you, where's your eye going to go? And more often than not, they always gravitated and rested on the traditional building. So it's these kind of tools, right? And where that they can help us inform our decisions. I think as designers, early on, if you're in the concept phase and you've got a couple of sketches, you could run this through that kind of softwares to help you say what's going to be more visually engaging. And surprisingly, it's not always just the jagged edge avant-garde architecture.
Yeah. I can imagine people who are not in favor of traditional architecture would just very easily dismiss this, well, this science. What do you think? Can you think it can be dismissed just out of hand? Like, yeah, the studies are not set up well, or do you think there are some ways they could dispel this research? Or do you think it's pretty watertight?
With any study, there's always going to be limitations and flaws to it. The research design component, you didn't get enough sample survey of people, or you've got this setting and you're setting up the table, the deck of cards in your favor, right? Those kind of things. Yeah. And so there's always going to be that. What I think the Enlightenment and scientific revolution has come to show us, however, is that over time, as other researchers do similar studies or they test the same thing to see if they get the same results in another way, or they correct some of the variables, that's the beauty of science. We're trying to get closer and closer to the truth. And as we do that, it will come forward. Whether we like the results or not, that's to be debatable. But I think a large part of it is going back to the education of the architect in many ways, because I was trained in a modern school. And to be honest, I was designing buildings that were all glass and steel and that were concrete. And I was married at the time. And my wife would say, these things are ugly. I don't feel warm. And then we'd go to a classical museum in Los Angeles or something. And she'd be like, yeah, this is what you should be designing. And I'm like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. My professors are experts in this, and they know exactly what is good architecture, right? And so part of that is you're, I don't know if you want to call it indoctrinated, right? To believe a certain thing, it almost becomes like a religious belief system. And so most architects out in practice believe this. wholeheartedly because they've been taught it and they trust and believe in their professors and others. But the science has an opportunity to maybe correct some of that, those misconceptions and the problem we have in education.
Yeah. So yeah, you get a research and then people get stimulated by this research and they do their own research. And yeah, then like a body of knowledge is starting to form, getting closer and closer to truth. I can imagine. You called it the indoctrination part, or the completely different way of looking at buildings is what I find very interesting, because I also had a switch of mindset. But I have this feeling that a lot of people think that for some reason the architects know better, but still they have this preference for traditional classical architecture. So they know, like, well, the specialists know what's best for us, and probably there is no other choice for some reason to build in a modern way in this time, until they discover that actually that's not the case. And you can actually still build traditionally and classically. It's perfectly possible. It's not illegal. Actually, it has a lot of benefits. And once you start to see that reality, or yeah, your paradigm, your personal paradigm shifts, then there's no way back, I feel. And that's, I think, what... Well, that's what happened to me. I'm not sure if that's happened for you as well. But yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, it definitely was a paradigm shift for me. Like I explained, I did study at two modern schools, although I was seeking for these principles and proportions. But it wasn't until I was in practice as an architect and I had a client that specifically asked for a classical building. Was able to persuade, right, the company I was working for, can you send me to some trainings, right, to learn this stuff that I didn't learn in school? Because if we're going to create a classical building, we don't want it to look goofy and postmodern in a way where classical elements are just blown out of proportion and they look awkward, right? I want to do it right. And so was able to go through kind of trainings, not through the academy, not through the established universities, through the nonprofit, the Institute of Classical Architecture and Art. There is a paradigm shift. I think that some people will come to realize over time if they are able to encounter it. But I think there'll always be this opposition. To be honest, I don't think at some utopian state we're all going to embrace, right, the classical traditional vernacular. That there's just in the human spirit, right, there's sometimes this sentiment of rebellion or against the established order. And maybe I'm in some ways the unorthodox architect because I'm going against the status quo here, right, with all my colleagues and others. But I know it's a phenomenon that I think does happen. And if you're humble enough, and this is another thing, one of my mentors when I was studying at the Catholic universities, Finnish architect, Juhani Palasma, and he focuses a lot on phenomenology and the experience and the connection of emotions and our senses to architecture. And wonderful human being, and introduced me to the importance of gaining compassion and empathy and humility for the building user, the person that's actually going to be using the building, instead of just me doing self-expression through my architecture and artwork, right? And I don't care what everyone else thinks. I'm the artist, right? But instead, what is the larger good? How can I contribute to the community, to the broader world, and others that are going to be actually using the building? And, you know, I've met a lot of what we call starchitects through the years, and some of them are complete jerks. Not kind human beings at all. And they're very arrogant and prideful. And so when I approach my students, I tell them, you need to be humble right? First off, to learn from other traditions. You could be designing in a foreign context, studying abroad in another place, that kind of helps open your eyes and traveling the world to appreciate beauty in other ways. But being humble enough to learn from other traditions, that is a key that not everybody has. And architects are really actually taught the opposite, to be arrogant and to be, I know best and my client doesn't know. I am the architect, kind of like the Fountainhead scenario you're talking about, right? I'm not willing to give up this for the masses, but I would encourage others to be humble, passion, and to show empathy.
Yeah, I think that's a good lesson for any human being, but even more for architects who build stuff that should last for a long time, probably will last for some time and will have a big effect on everybody being close to those buildings every day. Maybe moving on to the question of meaning. So today's architecture seems to suffer from a lack of meaning in a lot of cases. And why do you think that is? And can we do anything about it?
I think part of this was post-Enlightenment. And sometimes there's a desire to separate faith and reason, right? Or the subjective versus the objective, right? We need to only have measurable things. But one thing that has happened in architecture is the transition from modernism to postmodernism. There's an interesting tie there, right? Robert Venturi and others, Michael Graves, and there was an emphasis once again on meaning in architecture. So the discussion against all disconnect to ties of the past, we're only designing a building to be a living machine, like Wozier often said, it's all about the function, right? And minimalism, less is more, and those kind of things. So the postmodernism was really a return to meaning and opened up that door, that floodgate, if you will. And human beings were thirsting and hungering for meaning. And I think the same thing is true now, still today, right? We have environments that are in this. It's not to say that we are in an apocalyptic world or anything like that, but the built environment, 70% of our time as human beings is spent in buildings. And if they're designed poorly, then it's going to affect us as human beings, our cognitive, emotional, behavioral health, those kind of things. And so with that, I think the design industry in and of itself has an opportunity to change the chaos it's in some ways created and transform it into cosmos, which is really ordering space, right? And so if you're looking at it from a religious standpoint, that there is this loss of faith and ties to religion, but there is this new movement and hunger for broader spirituality. And I think it's because we're looking for connection. We're looking for meaning. And we can't find it really in the built environment. So where are we going to go? And so a lot of the phenomena is we're going to go to nature. We're going to go to the original textbook on beauty. And so people, right, go out into the wilderness to find beauty and to find themselves and the transcendental in a ways, because we can't find it in the built environment because there's been a disconnect.
Yeah. What do you think is the main driver of transcendental qualities and experiences in humans in buildings? Why do some places have transcendental qualities and others not? And what makes them impressionable on us?
Yeah, so with that, I kind of go back to some of my research I did on the Chartres Cathedral, the Pantheon, and the chapel at Ronchamp. And what were the transcendental qualities? I did one of two things with this research. One, I analyzed it from a geometry standpoint, an experiential standpoint, to see what were the architectural moves that could create lasting, memorable experiences for people. And then I used survey database of people that actually went to these buildings. And it was fascinating to see what they reported and why this experience was extraordinary and how it transformed their view on life and architecture. And one of the things that was so powerful about reading these experiences was there was a direct correlation between people's experience and how it affected them, transformed them, and almost had this transcendental effect or transformative effect on their human understanding and the architecture itself. And the demographics in that, that's an interesting thing in and of itself. But most of the participants at Ronchamp by Le Corbusier who yeah. had this experience were architects. Those that experienced it at the Pantheon and at Chartres Cathedral, there were some architects, but most of them were not architects. And so that kind of goes into that bias of how we're trained to view certain things and the beauty and whatnot. But it goes back to that principle of the transcendental qualities are inherent, number one, in nature. And the classical tradition emerges from emulating nature. And with that, when we see architecture that has these fractal patterns, these proportions, these geometries, they do appear to us transcendental because they actually resonate with us as biological human beings because our bodies are fractal in nature as well.
Yeah. And perhaps caves, large open spaces, but maybe woods where you have these almost the trees as columns. I was also thinking when you were talking about architects having this experience in Le Corbusier's building, what, maybe a crazy thought, but if the entire world population would be educated as an architect, would more people have these transcendental experiences with modernist buildings, basically?
It's a good question. And that dives into the neuroscience side of things. You know, we have the argument nature versus nurture. Right. Yeah. Where as human beings, we're nurtured and we learn and we grew up in a certain place, a country, a language, those kind of things. And that affects us, who we are. Right. And it becomes part of our cognitive memory.
Yeah.
But we also have the biological sense of the brain, the nature, and we do react in certain ways. And what the science shows us is that if we're presented and we see an image, or let alone not just an image, but a real lion is in front of us, one of two things is going to happen, right? Our fight or our flight reactions come into play. And, you know, with our nervous system and whatnot. And so with that, you can be educated to a certain extent to say, yeah, I find beauty in this. But some of the software and eye tracking simulation and neuroscience shows us that before our cognitive processes come into play, before me as Brandon, as myself, and my education and my gender and my race and all in my age, all those things, before they come into play, we make a judgment of an image, of the sensory
stimuli instinctively,
and that's the nature side of things and what neuroscience shows us. And what is being revealed is that beauty is no longer in the eye of the beholder, as we once thought. It's so subjective. Well, you know, it's like everyone has their different taste and those kind of things. But there are aspects of beauty that are actually in the brain of the beholder. And so because of that, we are confronted with this ethical situation of, well, if beauty can be measurable, then as architects, we're probably should be held to a higher level of responsibility, and we should take our stewardship with health and well-being and view it at a higher level.
Yeah. So architects should focus and learn more about neuroaesthetics and neuroscience, in your opinion, to take into account the psychological effects of architecture on people?
Exactly. And there's a new movement called evidence-based design. And I think you touched on this in your video, but some of my research focuses on that. And it's really just, it's what doctors and lawyers do, right? They look at the best evidence and case law. If you're an attorney or if you're a doctor, you're looking at the research and how certain things will affect the outcomes of a certain situation. And really, it should be applied to architecture, where we take those best practices, evidence, and apply it to our designs.
Yeah. I can imagine in some places, this will come down to local traditions being rediscovered, basically. Because if you go back to local building materials, local realities, and also the neuroscience part of things, like what would be, for example, in a little village somewhere in France, like the best and most visually pleasing way to use the local materials and the local craft available, and you might end up with half-timbered houses if you don't have access to glass, steel, and concrete, and you still want to build a building that is visually pleasing with local materials, then it might be just a very logical way to build buildings that are also visually pleasing. So I think that might be an interesting outcome. I don't know what you think about this, but...
I think you just hit the nail on the head there. You know, with sustainability and the sustainability movement, and building local is the way to go. And really, that's how we built for thousands of years, was really focusing on local materials and whatnot. And that's what gave each place its sense of character and its cultural expression that was unique to the people that lived there, and the craftsmen. The problem with today is with the international movement and globalism and others, is that we have architects that are designing outside of their cultural geographic upbringing, and they don't understand the local trades or materials and things like that. So there's an approach to where, right, you focus back on the local vernacular and how you can use those to build lasting buildings. But part of the problem also is that we've lost the skill set. 100 years, the modern movement has really dominated architectural discourse and the building industry. And so because of that, a lot of those skills have been lost. But I think there's new emerging technologies that can help us restore this sense of place and the craftsmen and other things. For instance, when I was working on those temple projects, we worked with a local artist to sculpt out of clay some ornamental motifs. But then we 3D scanned those sculptures. We put them in a software, and then we were able to cut them out of stone with a CNC process to get them pretty close to where they needed to be. And then the last finishing touches were done by the crafts people. So I think there's a hybrid, right, where you can use some of the digital technologies and methods to bring these things back.
Yeah. And new technologies like 3D printing, robotic construction, etc. for architecture, how do you think these could be married with traditional architecture and craftsmanship? Like, is there a way forward, you think?
I definitely think there is, but we also have to be cautious. I put on my suspicious hat as well, because a lot of the love of technology, the technophilia, if you will, of the modernists, and why we're here, where we're at, is because we're always pushing the innovation button and trying to create new materials, building materials and assemblies. Unfortunately, many of these have not been tested, so they don't last the test of time, and they break down and our buildings leak and other things like that. But, and it's not that we have a technophobia, right? We're not scared of the technology, but it's a cautious approach to not let technology overtake our lives. You know, there's lots of studies that have come out about how the youth and the next generation are addicted to technology, right? with their phones. They can't even go without touching their phone. It's almost like a drug in a way. And so we have to be careful, I think, in some embracing all technologies, but using the best of them to aid in this process. So 3D printing, a lot of our students will use 3D printing as a way of visualizing their projects. We're also looking at how can you use 3D printing to get a base for something and then add something to it with clay or things like that. But all of this, I think, has potential and opportunities. In fact, I was talking with one of my colleagues who's starting a new program in the traditional building arts down at Snow College here in Utah. And they're looking at ways to go to a historic building, capture like a 3D scan of an element, and then put that data into the CNC machine and manipulate it so that they can create new objects or from a historic preservation standpoint. And so the technologies are wonderful that are coming out. But once again, I just cautious the over-reliance on them, especially when it comes to educating the architect, because there's important connections between the hand, the eyes, and the mind that need to be made. Otherwise, their visual thinking and imagination is stunted by whatever computer software that they're using, things like that.
Yeah. I think it's also an easy trap to fall into thinking that you can solve these problems in which technology is lacking, to solve these problems by applying even more technology. Like I'm thinking of learning with a video course on how to build a wooden framed home, for example, but then you don't have the hand eye connection and seeing like, well, maybe the solution is having like a VR simulator to simulate you building those buildings and hoisting those pillars in place, but then you only use even more technology, which is even more complex, to solve something that could also just be done in a field with some wooden beams. But yeah, if we stay on this path of technological progress, unless something happens, I'm not sure if we can take some kind of a different route as a society towards a future in which we also learn these traditions in schools for craftsmen, for example, or if it will be, like this train that just storms on to the future using more and more technology until we are, you could almost think of the whole transhumanist movement, Neuralink chips, robots doing all the work, and us just playing games in VR and perhaps giving the order to build something. Like that is the hyper technological future. But if something happens and our international supply chains break, I mean, if we run out of diesel tomorrow, we have a major problem and we can't even build like we're doing now anymore. So yeah, those are the two futures I see personally. I don't know where you fall in that spectrum, but...
Well, I think traditional architecture has the ability to solve a lot of the problems that are on the agenda, right? Climate problem, sustainability, some of the social justice, inequality issues, those kind of things. And from an urban planning standpoint, it really has an opportunity to help mend. And like we said earlier, the chaos of our environments to create a cosmos, a utopia in a way. Just from the fact of how it's approaching the problem solving in and of itself. But yeah, some of the future, I've got some colleagues here at Utah Valley that are really doing some cutting edge in the digital media realm with exploring things with the metaverse. You've probably heard of that. Yeah. And the AI, the augmented reality and things like that. And we've looked at it and dabbled in it a little bit. But once again, we go back to the human touch. And there's something that's lost with the machine. A sense of authenticity in a way. And that's one thing you just lose with industrialization and mass production and things like that.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, thank you so far for all these wonderful answers and thoughts and ideas. Quite some rabbit holes we've gone down. So do you have any other hopes or ideas for the future or things for the listeners in general you would like to express?
Yeah, so there's four principles, and I recently presented these at a conference. So if you subscribe to the YouTube channel, you'll see that presentation soon. But the four ideals, I guess, I would recommend for the future of architecture and education and the profession in general is, and what we teach our, try to teach our students here at Utah Valley, is to design with beauty in mind. And starting to do that with the principles that we've been talking about, sacred geometry, fractals, proportions, those kind of things. The second is defend the authentic. And what I mean by defending the authentic, we touched a little bit about this just a minute ago, but it's the authenticity of place, its culture, its time, its history, its memories. Architecture needs to do that. The third is we started with timeless, but really building for time, where architecture is thinking about the long term and thinking not in terms of decades, but in terms of generations. And that's a more holistic, sustainable, and I would say caring approach to design, and also communicating that to our clients. And then lastly is just inspiring the human spirit through designs. And I think if we apply some of these principles, we will create environments that not only promote health and well-being from a cognitive, emotional, behavioral standpoint, right, but actually environments that will inspire us to go beyond and to become the next renaissance of human knowledge and things like that. So four ideals: designing with beauty, defending the authentic, building for time, and inspiring the spirit. That's what I would recommend them.
Yeah, wonderful. I think those are excellent, four excellent points. I would almost want to steal them and put them on my website, but they are, it's kind of encapsulate what my vision is for architecture as well, really beautifully. So thank you for that. And I will definitely send people to your YouTube channel so they can subscribe to you. I think that's a wonderful end to this interview. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Ruben. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Aesthetic City podcast. You can find more information about Professor Rowe on his website, brandonrowe.com. In the description, I have added links to his YouTube channel and his publications. If you like our content and want to support what we do, you can support us in various ways. The easiest way is to give this podcast a favorable review and to share it with your colleagues and friends. You can also support us by following us on our Twitter, subscribing to our YouTube channel, or our Substack newsletter. But the best way of supporting our work is becoming a patron, which comes with many additional benefits. Visit the Patreon link in the description below to learn more. For more information about The Aesthetic City, visit theaestheticcity.com. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. Thank you. Until next time.